Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Sloane Crosley, who has a collection of essays, I Was Told There'd Be Cake, about her life. Sloane Crosley is also a publicist over at Vintage Books, and it's very, very rare that I get someone from the business side of the book business. So I'm going to blindside you a little bit later with some questions about what's happening in the book business, because as someone who deals with publicity and with the suits and with the talent, you're kind of crossing over from one to the other. Your book, this collection of essays, is autobiographical but seems to stop when it comes to your job. And let me start there. Why are there no essays about your work doing the publicity with all these famous writers?
That's a good question. No one's actually asked me that. I think I've just been so used to keeping it church and state, because my job within the publishing industry is to sort of be the spokeswoman, if you will, for it, and to call up, you know, producers or, you know, radio shows like this one, newspapers, magazines, and pitch other people. And it always, you know, when I started freelancing and, you know, an article would appear in the New York Times or an article would appear, I don't know, there was one that appeared in Playboy, which was actually kind of interesting, you know, to see which book editors were reading that one. And they would say, you know, my name's kind of like a license plate.
Right.
So they'd say, are you the same Sloane Crosley? And I didn't even know how to respond, just because I didn't want it to seem like I was using my authors to sort of further myself. I just felt it's sort of a weird betrayal to write about them. You know, maybe when I'm 80, I'll tell all my crazy author stories.
Let's start, first of all, with this book. Had you been doing a lot of writing all along? I mean, you got into publishing. Your first job was with this crazy woman named Ursula, not her real name, I would guess.
That is not her real name. I still live in mild fear of her, so it's certainly a fake name. Yeah. Like a lot of people who are big readers, sort of, you know, majored in English in college, that kind of thing. And the first thing I wanted to do when I got out was either work for magazines or work for book publishing. And it's funny because now I love my job, but people assume that it's a real definite choice. But I just couldn't find a job in magazines. So I found one in book publishing and loved it.
Did you write?
I've always written a little bit. This specific essay collection came about because I sort of brilliantly locked myself out of two different apartments in the same day while moving in Manhattan, and it was especially harrowing. So I wrote an email to a bunch of friends, including one who worked at the Village Voice. He said if I cleaned it up, I could turn it into an essay. But I had written long before that, but that's how the collection started.
Were the other essays then written afterward?
All the other essays were written afterwards. In fact, there are only two from The Voice, and the rest are really sort of brand new, and that's how I sort of got into it.
What was the other one that was published?
There's another one in there about me being a really bad vegetarian, which is not the right town to admit that you're secretly eating fish when you're supposed to be a vegetarian, but I was a pescatarian. It was a sort of confessional, hello, my name is Sloane and I eat fish.
Well, Sloane Crosley, let's talk a little about some of the material in here. Now, there's a long essay about your being in a marriage party with a friend who was not really a friend. First of all, has that person seen this essay?
She certainly has. So there are 15 essays in the book, 12 of them which sort of unabashedly poke fun at me, and three of them that I guess could be categorized as lashing out, if you will, a sort of Larry David type situation in which I sort of turned the judgmental meter on other people. And I warned her about it, and I sent it to her, and obviously she's not thrilled about it.
What did she say?
What's interesting is what people get upset about. It's on the surface, it's the details. You know, well, I didn't do this or I didn't say this one thing. I was like, but that's never what's really upsetting. Does it matter if, you know, you lost a pearl from your dress? Does it matter if you did this or you did that? It's more the heart of the essay.
And in her case, she was complaining about the little things and seems to have overlooked the fact that you were in the maid of honor to a woman you barely knew.
Basically, I mean, I knew her quite well when I was younger, and, you know, she made a lovely bride, and, you know, I certainly wasn't thinking about taking notes for this essay while I was in the wedding, but it happened to come along at the time when I was really sort of thinking about female friendships and the weird requirements of them, you know, the wedding being sort of the ultimate kind of triathlon of a test of your friendship.
You wrote that first essay for The Voice, and it got published.
What happened was, as I started writing for The Voice more and more regularly, I had written really fiction up until then. I have a novel that I wrote, which is really bad, and I've since, you know, subsequently put it in a drawer. I should really bury it. Should I get, you know, killed in a freak accident and someone tries to publish it, would be not good. I started writing for The Voice really regularly. But the thing is, you know, publications will only give you, 600 to 1,200 words. If you really want room to write a real narrative nonfiction essay, you have to experiment on your own.
So you just began writing on your own, not knowing what was going to happen with this stuff?
I didn't know. Well, a theme sort of emerged eventually, which is sort of that theme of the sort of humor of coming age, of comedic disappointment. And a lot of the essays I've read that I've loved, as everyone else has, you know, people who are just incredibly talented, David Rykoff, David Sedaris. Some of their essays, though, tend to end in sort of a neat little package, you know, it's like a little piece of candy tied neatly at the ends. And I didn't want to write like that. I don't think you learn a lesson every single time.
Did you feel any kind of trepidation about writing not necessarily fully complimentary pieces about ex-boyfriends, ex-roommates, parents?
My parents are actually fine with it. I mean, the worst my parents have said is, you know, one parent will say, I never said that, and the other parent will say, oh, yes, you did. So that's fine. And they're painted, I like to think of them as sort of the written version of, you know, those Hirschfeld drawings that have, like, one defining line. If you choose to see yourself, that's fine. But, you know, except for very few pieces, none of the descriptions that are negative are specifically incriminating, I don't think.
Did you change a lot of names?
Oh, yeah, all of them, except for my family, because, you know.
You grew up in Westchester in a non-religious Jewish household. You had a Christmas tree.
A big one.
Every year?
Oh, yeah. And not only do I have a Christmas tree, I mean, that's not like we just sort of plopped it up in the living room and forgot about it. I mean, everything that goes along with the Christmas tree, you know, people's favorite ornaments, you know, who goes to buy the tree, who gets to hang certain ornaments, the whole thing. So we got pretty far into it and pretty far away from, you know, Jewish traditions except for the menorah.
Did your family do the Seder thing over Passover?
We do the Seder thing. Yeah, that's the other thing. We do Seder. My mom makes an excellent kugel. You know, I think we are, like a lot of people, I mean, I assume nationwide and specifically in the Northeast, very much defined as cultural Jews. You know, all the trappings and not a whole lot of the temple.
Sloane Crosley, in writing these, how tempted were you to move in political areas, into areas where you could go past just your own personal stories?
Hopefully I'm tempted in every essay. The ones that didn't make it into the collection didn't make it in for a very specific reason, which is that they don't become universal. They are basically sort of elaborate diary entries, or I'm too close to them to sort of extract any universal meaning from them. So hopefully each essay is, you know, this weird phenomenon how the more detailed you get, the more people relate to it. It shouldn't work that way. It's like how bees physically aren't supposed to fly, their wingspan's too short, you know. In terms of the political, you know, aspect of it, they're pretty isolated. I mean, culturally, they certainly, just the way sort of how we were Jewish, you know, culturally, there's a lot of sort of cultural markers of the 80s and 90s, but it's hard to touch on that kind of stuff in a humor essay. There's one essay that touches on 9/11, and I probably worked on that part more than any other section of the book to try to do it right.
Now, where were you at that moment?
I was on the subway. I was on the 9 train, and I was actually all the way up, underground, but all the way up by 42nd Street, and the train rattled and stopped because it's connected to that line.
Did you get out at that point?
Well, I got out because it was my stop, yes. And I walked into Times Square, and it was sort of like some sort of terrible Armageddon movie where there were just everybody was frozen on the street and looking up at all the TV screens in Times Square.
Did you see the smoke also if you looked south?
I did, and everybody thought the same thing. Everybody thought, and it sounds flippant to say now, but you know, within moments of it, everyone thought, what idiot flew their, like, two-prop plane into the World Trade Center.
Which is sort of what happened a few years later when the Yankee pitcher did that, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, what was your feeling afterward? I mean, how did you look at Giuliani? How did you look at Bush? I mean, later on, of course, reality settled in.
Right. I think Giuliani was an instant hero. I mean, that's sort of not debatable. I think to be that organized and to sort of rally people and to comfort a city in its, you know, darkest time, you know, really in that century, I think that's phenomenal. Obviously, it's not presidential. But, you know, Bush, I mean, nothing good.
You wrote a cover story for the worst-selling Maxim magazine of all time. You went to L.A. to interview the women of One Tree Hill. Never read the magazine, never saw the show. They called you, I would guess.
Oh, yes.
And what prompted you to actually do it and not see the show?
Well, I had never done it before, so that's a good enough reason to do anything, I think, and something that's definitely prevalent throughout the collection. That's actually not in the collection. I thought it'd be fun. I thought it'd be a good trip to LA. And the other thing is I work as a publicist. We're constantly sending things out. We're constantly giving things to people. We don't get a lot in return. You know, maybe free galleys from other publishing houses. But working with all the media, it's like a world of swag, you know, and we don't see any of it. And here someone said, you know, would you like to, you know, go and interview a couple of grade B but edible celebrities? Yeah, I thought it might be kind of fun. I think they sent me out there because they wanted me to sort of level with them and have some girl talk with them, and it worked.
Had you done much interviewing before?
No, I interviewed Sarah Silverman over email once. I just interviewed Jonathan Safran Foer over email. I don't really, I mean, the thing is, as a personal essayist, I make a pretty crappy interviewer because I'm obviously there's a little bit of self-centeredness involved.
This book is published by Penguin, which is not Bertelsmann Company. Did you feel like you couldn't submit it to them? How did that work?
That is also the sort of church and state analogy comes back, or something about, you know, defecating where you eat. Yeah, I didn't think, I mean, honestly, I would have been honored. I work for the Knopf imprint, and I would have been completely honored to have it be published by us. But it's not the kind of thing we would publish, I don't think. And it's also, you know, how would I possibly do my day job? You know, I'd call up a book editor and say, hi, it's Sloan. I'm calling about myself. I'm in, available for interviews. Oh, what time is it? Now is good. Give myself a huge budget. You know, I really think we should do some extra advertising for this title.
Do you second guess your publicist then? How does that work?
No, I mean, that woman is a saint. I micromanage. I'm sure it's, you know, impossible to stop. But I hopefully think it's been more helpful than anything else. I feel like I hand her a lot of things. And she's very patient with it as well. So it's actually been a really, really good experience.
How'd you get the gig at Random House?
Like I said, I couldn't find a job in magazines right after I graduated. And I had a friend who had gone to the Radcliffe Publishing course, which I think is now at Columbia, where you pay sort of an exorbitant amount of a couple thousand dollars to go to this intensive, you know, course where people from the publishing industry talk to you, and then you throw your resume in a basket at the end of the course. So I said, how was it? And she, you know, told me about different aspects of it. And she said, you know, and literary agents came to talk to us. And I thought, oh, sure, literary agents. So I Googled literary agents. and I found a big database of them. And I sent my resume to about 50 of them. And a couple of them happened to have openings. It was really good. It's a good way to get into it.
And that was Ursula.
Yes.
Once you left Ursula, which was September 11th, right?
Yeah.
Was September 11th, 2001. What happened at that point? You were out of a job. You had an apartment. You were sharing an apartment in Manhattan at that point, and you were out of a job. What did you do?
All my internships had been in magazines. I was really lucky in the fact that I had worked in at The New Yorker and Mirabella, which actually shut the summer I worked at it. And actually, I worked at The New Yorker the summer Tina Brown left. I'm apparently poisoned to magazines. So book publishing, the end that I was in, you know, literary agenting, was a little bit too slow. I mean, it's where all the money is, allegedly, but it was just a little bit frustrating sort of reading, especially wanting to write myself, reading bad manuscript after bad manuscript. It becomes the difference between bad and not that bad. I sort of wanted to get back into magazines but stay in books, and publicity is the perfect marriage of that, because in a way, I work for every magazine.
So you applied to a whole bunch of them?
I had a friend of a friend of a friend who was out one night. I had my resumes on me. I happened to just be looking for a job, and she said there might be an opening at HarperCollins. So I gave her the resume and interviewed with the director there. And then after about 10 months at HarperCollins, I got a call from Vintage, and that is all she wrote.
You're listening to an interview with Sloan Crosley, whose collection of essays is titled I Was Told There'd Be Cake. What did you really know about book publicity at that point? Just
nothing.
What you'd seen? Nothing?
Absolutely nothing. I actually didn't even know anything after having done it for 10 months. I still don't know anything about it. I mean, it's such a strange, amorphous kind of thing. You know, you'll sit in marketing meetings and people will say, well, you know, what about the Wall Street Journal? Can we get them to do it? And I thought, you think, great, you know, do you have some roofies? And
a lot of people are really interested in this, particularly people who try to self-publish or promote themselves. Okay, so Sloan Crosley, here you are, you're in your office, it's time for a meeting. At that point, you don't necessarily know what you're promoting, or do you, because these are paperbacks that came from Knopf?
Oh, well, yeah, of course we know what we're promoting. I mean, it's not totally reinventing the wheel. I think that, you know, Knopf and Vintage have a very good formula in terms of, you know, how do we talk to BNN, who buys the books, and then publicity-wise, who might cover this, and we have a huge database. It's a well-oiled machine, which is the, advantage of not being self-published is that you have, you know, years of experience and funds behind you. But, you know, we try to do something creative with each book.
So you go into this meeting and people throw around ideas. What about the Wall Street Journal? What about a tour? And then you offer your own input at
that
point.
And then we offer, yeah, exactly. And I've been working there for about six years. So by now I have a sense of, you know, well, that's not a great city for media. Chicago is weirdly a bad city for media. I don't know why that is. It shouldn't be, but it's really tough to get media in Chicago. So we tend to only send, like, bigger authors there. You know, there's certain things you just know inherently. It's like any job. You know, it's hard to explain why you...
What about the Bay Area? How do you guys perceive that?
We love the Bay Area. You guys are huge. You're a huge book-buying audience. You know, you and Seattle and Austin. Austin's great, too.
What involvement do the suits have, the money people? And can you push back and say, you know, I don't care if so-and-so's last four books were terrible. This one is great. And I don't care if it did lousy in hardback, but this one needs to, we really need to promote it because I think this is a winner. And even if it's not, people should read it. Do you have any of that power?
Yes. I mean, not to spew forth the Kool-Aid, which I've obviously been doing shots of at Vintage for six years, but that's what's great about it. We, you know, you said the suits, and very few people are wearing suits.
Well, but I mean, you know.
No, but I mean that, though, as a, you know, in the metaphor sense, too, you know, both literally and, you know, I think that certainly the budgets don't get set by me. But, you know, if something's really worthwhile or something's, you know, not worthwhile, we can figure it out. And we all work on the same floor, you know, and I get input to editorial content and cover art and all sorts of stuff. And publicity is sort of you're out there on the front lines, as it were, trying to garner attention for books. And you know what's possible and what's not. So if someone's got a great venue, you can talk to people about sending them there.
And what about the loss of a lot of these independent distributors? Does that affect you in any way?
Sure. You know, Dutton's just closed in L.A. It all affects us. You know, we're a huge fan of the independents. Most of the stores that I'm going on tour for, you know, for I Was Told There'd Be Cake are independent bookstores. And, you know, it's the same way the Atlanta Journal cut their book section. And it was devastating because that was the real big voice of the South, which is an area that the rest of the country is already feeling a little bit disconnected from. And we relied on it. So that was actually, you know, it was pretty devastating for all of us.
Let's suppose that for some reason this book didn't sell to a major publisher. Would you have given up on it and put it in a drawer, or would you have tried to self-publish? What would you have done?
I sold the book on a proposal, so it's not like there was a huge amount of essays just sitting there prepackaged and ready to go. You know, I wrote it, and, you know, as the theme of sort of, you know, the coming of age and the disappointment and the comedy of it emerged, it already had a home to sort of grow in, like to grow in. But so it probably would have still existed because I love writing nonfiction and I still would have written it, but it's not the same thing as the, again, terrible novel that I wrote, which will never see the light
of
day.
Well, the reason I'm asking is I'm trying to get a sense. A lot of people around here write, and sometimes for whatever reason, it doesn't get picked up, and it could be because the trends are in a different direction. Let's suppose someone decides, I want to get it self-published or get it published by a small press that doesn't have the publicity money and I got to do it myself. What do they do? What would you say that they should do?
Well, I think the first thing you should do really before you, you know, go the sort of, you know, go on a website or go the self-publishing route is really try to find an agent who you look in there's a book called The LMP, Literary Marketplace, which I'm sure is online by now, but it used to just be this big giant phone book of every publishing house and every agent, and really try to find someone who would represent you first. I think it's a really bad idea to just send your book blindly to a publishing house. I mean, there are stories, apparently, you know, I wouldn't rely on those stories at all. So I think even if you're self-published, I think the best thing to do is either if you can't find an agent and you're just self-published is spend a couple $1,000s, really try to, you know, scrounge it together and talk to, you know, a publicist or somebody who might take you on to try to get your book out there, because there's no way you're going to be able to do the whole machinery we just discussed of getting the books in the stores in the same way, but that is something that's in your control.
People shouldn't try to do the publicity themselves.
You can try. I think it's important to be active in your own publicity, and it's important to research things. It's hard to talk about yourself. The fundamental reason why my job exists is because it means much more for me to say Richard is a great guy as opposed to you saying I'm a great guy.
What about the relationship between, say, doing a media event versus going to a bookstore and trying to do a reading?
I think if you go, you can get a lot of people at a bookstore if you do it. You know, there's a lot of community outreach. Let's say, you know, you write a book on pineapples. You find out where the local pineapple growers are, who's interested in them. You know, you look up online who's reviewed books about pineapples, you know. And just the trick is just playing to people's interests, I think.
And how about media? How much does a radio show like this one, for instance, help?
I think it helps a lot because there aren't that many anymore. So people who are interested in books and reading and writing and not so much arithmetic will flock to this kind of thing because they have to find it and seek it out.
Well, now you're in the book business, and do you plan to continue it, or do you plan to become a permanent writer?
A permanent writer. Well, I'm really lucky in that the book's been and received pretty well and is doing pretty well. But
that's funny. I mean,
thank you. Yeah, people like to chortle. I haven't quite figured out what I'm going to do yet. I can't imagine. I think for fiction, it takes a little bit of isolation. I think you have to enter into that world that you've made up and created. Whereas nonfiction, and especially in these essays, a lot of it is reactionary. You know, you live in the world, you react off of a silly situation, a first job, you know, my stint is trying to volunteer, that kind of thing. And I can't imagine not having some sort of employment. And then compounding that all is that I wouldn't have health insurance.
Where is the publishing industry going these days, do you think?
Down the tubes. No, I'm kidding. You know, everybody, every 5 years, someone purports the end of it. You know, the Kindle will kill it. You know, the end of independent bookstores will kill it. You know, everything is going to be published this way. You know, there are too many books published. There are not enough books published. I think that all I can really say from my limited perspective as not one of the money people is at least we're not the music industry, which is really in trouble.
Right. How much book buying goes online these days versus, you know, in stores?
A tremendous amount, especially in places where are, you know, non-urban centers where it's much easier to go on Amazon or Powell's than it is to, you know, drive 20 minutes and, you know, stop it in at a local store. And but with the bricks and mortar stuff is still strong. I mean, the thing is, I don't really know. I can't really speak that much to it. I don't know what's going on. I do know that, you know, BNN is shutting a couple of stores that have been there forever in Manhattan, but they also just opened this amazing, beautiful store downtown in Tribeca. So, you know, and McNally Robinson, again, in New York, is a store that's, you know, now succeeded so well, they're opening up a second branch of it. So it's hard to pinpoint.
In terms of the actual sale of books, somebody who deals with reprints, you're functioning in a slightly different level, but you see what's going on throughout the many different strands of Random House, Knopf, and so on. You see a lot of books of one particular type emerge, like books set in India for 5 months, and then it's gone. Friendships between black women, and then that's gone.
My book's a paperback original, and we also publish a lot of paperback originals, so we're sort of part of that machine as well. You know, it's funny. I think that some books do get crashed, which is sort of the term for when you rush every single part of the process. Normally, a book is like a baby. It takes, you know, 9 months to a year. Well, hopefully no babies take a year because that poor mother
really
is going down the Guinness book. But I'm always amazed by that. Part of me thinks that's sort of a media machine. I mean, like you said, you actually see it, so maybe there's real evidence. But it's the same reason why I look at, you know, at a fashion magazine and, you know, you can actually point to definite trends and people say, you know, neon green is the new thing, I'm telling you. And sure enough, every designer who, in theory, has been working alone with their own team by themselves produces the same thing at the same time. These cultural phenomenons just sort of, you can find one right now. If you wanted me to find you a bunch of book on frogs, you know, or a bunch of books with one-word titles, I could, you know.
Well, what are the real trends now? I mean, when you go back to your day job, what kind of stuff will you be seeing that's just trendy for, say, this year?
Well, actually, I just wrote a piece for PW on lengthy titles, which obviously I am also a part of. You know, some of our most recent big books have had lengthy titles. You know, nonfiction, it seems, you know, say, blink, boink, buzz, you know, that kind of thing. And then fiction, you get, you know, special topics in calamity physics or, you know, and then we came to the end, you don't love me yet, you know. And so it's really, the titles themselves seem to be a bit of a trend.
And what about in terms of genres? Where is what they call chick lit these days?
I don't know. I don't publish a lot of chick lit. My book's not chick lit. I don't know a lot about it, to tell you the truth, except for what I see in terms of just the general hues of the cover. But, you know, it sells a lot of books to people that, that want them. So,
Do you ever fight with, like, the art department to say, you know, this book looks like this other book, or this book needs to have a different cover, I think you've got this wrong?
Editorial does, and authors do. We really don't. I mean, by the time it's shown to my sort of section, you know, it's like a choice between which font do you like better on this cover that's already kind of been decided. I mean, just like, I mean, with my cover, and they showed me my cover, I was shocked because it, at first, because it's got a lot of flowers on it. It's not a very girly book. And then I realized that it's actually the print of a vintage mattress, and I thought, okay, that's cool.
Why'd you decide the title would be, I was told there'd be cake, rather than one of the other essay titles?
One of the other. I think it puts so much, and maybe this is from working in publishing for too long, I think it puts a lot of pressure on a single essay or story to say, this is it. This is what's representative of the whole collection. So I just wanted something that captured the tone of sort of, you know, ridiculous, comedic.
Well, why did they decide on a trade paperback? And were you comfortable with that?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I've been working on paperback originals and fighting for them, saying, you know, people, you're asking a tremendous amount of someone when you're asking them to buy, you know, a $24 book, especially by an author they haven't heard of. And that's why in England, most of the books are published trade paperback original right away. I, you know, thought, well, let me put my money where my mouth is. And now that my own book's being published, I think a paperback original for a collection of essays is good.
And that brings up an interesting point, which is if people can't really afford the $25 to $30 book, why aren't more books being published as trade paperback originals where people can actually afford them?
Yeah. Well, if you're an established author, I mean, it's like anything. When you know that someone's going to pay for it, why would you not? You know, why would you think, oh, let me give the reading public a break when you're running a business? And a lot of people still love hardcovers. I mean, the thing is, I'm a complete publishing brat. I work in publishing. I try to buy books when I can, but I get a lot of books for free, and I like the way the hardcover looks on my shelf, and I like reading it and having it. You know, it's sort of physically stays longer. But I do actually think that many, many more books should be published as paperback originals.
I've noticed over the years, and I've heard from writers about this, that in the old days you'd get a book coming out, and even if the book was, say, you know, a B, not an A, mm-hmm. right, and the author was an A, and you knew the author would be getting better and better, and we all know that it takes three or four books to really get your feet wet.
Mm-hmm.
These days, it's like everybody expects a home run first time out, and if they don't get it, it's like, whoosh, it
just
becomes a struggle.
Disappointment, you mean?
Yeah.
I think people do expect that because there are enough examples. There are enough examples of first-time authors that just shot to the top of the list. I mean, in terms of paperback originals, the first two paperback originals that Vintage published were Bright Lights, Big City and The Sports Writer. You know, and then you have a lot of first-time, you know, young, hip authors come out and get a lot of press, and you think, well, why not me? And but there's sort of a fundamental problem to your question, which is that you're saying, you know, nobody knows they wrote a B novel. From what I can tell, especially at least where I work, is that you take the book and you make it the best book you can, and there's a lot of talk, you know, of, oh, this is an author we really want to grow. This is an author we're really invested in.
There is talk about
that. There's tons of talk about that. Of course there is. We're invested in people's careers.
What do you do when you read a book and you go, and it's handed to you because it's been a hardback, and you go, God, this one is really a dog. What do you do?
Again, I feel like because of where I work, I mean, Vintage and Anchor, we either do really sort of funky paperback originals, or we have all the paperbacks that come from Knopf and Doubleday. So we're not dealing with a lot of, you know, how to pluck your eyebrows in 5 minutes or less and, you know, having to pitch that kind of a book. So it's almost never a problem. There are problems where, you know, I'll read a book and think, well, this is just not something I'm very personally interested in, or I can see what this needs and, you know, maybe I don't have the right connections at certain places to make it happen. And that's why you have a department of more than, you know, we have a department of seven people, and there'll always be somebody. So I actually really don't work on any books where I'm, you know, picking up the phone saying, please just do me a favor and review this. You know, I'm pretty passionate about them all.
And if it's a book that politically you find kind of offensive, you'll just turn it over to someone
else. We turn it over to someone else. Or not even just, you know, politically offensive. I mean, I feel like there are other publicists who are, after you do a certain kind of book enough times, what happens is you're calling the same kind of people and you sort of develop a bit of a trust, you know, that this person knows what they're talking about. You know, when I call up and say this book is really, really good, you know, hopefully a producer or an editor will think, well, the last book she gave me was actually pretty good too. I honestly have had maybe two books ever that I've thought, like, I just can't do this. But that's the thing. That's sort of the common misunderstanding about what publicists do. It's like there's actually not a lot of lying that goes on. That's the only way to become good at your job. And it's just the way, like, gossip columnists, everyone assumes they have big mouths, but their real job is knowing when to not say anything.
Should authors have websites?
Oh, yes.
Really?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I think that, you know, all the stuff that you've been hinting at about, you know, the death of, you know, this kind of venue or this kind of book, I think a lot has gone on in the web. You know, we're putting more, you know, even advertising budgets on blogs and stuff like that. I just built a website that has a, or with Riverhead, of course, because I don't know HTML, so when I say I, that's a complete fabrication. They just built a website that has, you know, I made dioramas out of a couple of the essays. I thought that might be kind of fun. And we videotape them, and hopefully so there's like a video component. And it's SloaneCrosley.com.
I found this website of somebody who obviously doesn't like you.
Wow. Well, I think what's happened is because I have my job, it's treated, you know, it's okay. I get it. I get how people think that this is only being published, you know, because of the connections, and I must be a talentless hack. That must be the case. And, of course, I have moments when I think that. Yeah, I think there's a lot of it's weird. It's treated like nepotism in a funny way. I would have been really grateful for some old nepotism when I was graduating and looking for a job. But it's no more of a coincidence than, you know, the media coverage that it's getting, which has been really generous, is because of my job. But it's the same way when people get blurbs in the back of their books because they went to an MFA program with an author. That seems to be, you know, it seems to be the same thing.
Well, you have a lot of great blurbs here, and of course these are all honest blurbs, but
I hope.
How seriously should people take blurbs? And if you're looking at a collection like this and you don't know the author, what should you be looking at for an honest appraisal when you're looking at a jacket?
I think you should be looking, and it's a shame that people don't do this more. I mean, I'm very fortunate in the fact that some of the people that blurred my book, you know, that Colson Whitehead did, and, you know, Am Holmes and Megan Dahm and Jonathan Ames, and these people are amazing and really, really generous. You know, as much as I value their opinion, and I do, it's a shame that people are only looking for the name. They almost don't read the blurb. You know, you can tell when a blurb's enthusiastic. You can tell when a blurb says, you know, I laughed out loud in the subway, or, you know, I didn't get to sleep till 4 a.m., you know, and I think that really says something. You know, when I'm in a bookstore and pick up a book, and I think, oh, wow, that's, you know, that's, if that person who's written these things that I admire so admires this other person, it's like any friend of yours is a friend of mine, you know, theory. That's great. But then, you know, I look at the flap copy and I open up the book, and if I don't like it, I'm not going to think, oh, but, you know, Joyce Carol Oates really liked it. When I look at it, I look at the first page of the book. I actually start reading it.
You're kind of going to ignore, to some degree, the cover and all of that and just go.
No, you can judge a book by its cover. It's true. Don't believe the hype. You can definitely judge a book by its cover.
You think?
Oh, totally. I mean, I think that it's, you know, because enough people have read it that enough people have gone and decided, you know, what the cover should be like and what the audience they're going for. And maybe you don't like the cover, but you can tell about the cover. I'm not saying that I wouldn't buy a good book with an unattractive cover, but you can tell what it's aiming for, and I can think, well, maybe I don't like this cover, but it's clearly aiming for me.
Sloane Crosley, now you've written this, and this I took several months of gestation. How many more essays are sitting out there for another book? A year. How many more essays are sitting out there for another book now?
I keep on writing them. I love them. I mean, I think what's funny is after I finished writing the novel, I had so much fun writing the essays, and I hope that comes through in them, just because I felt like, you know, it seemed like, oh, I could rely on things that had happened. I didn't have to totally have the pressure of putting every facet and building a world from scratch. Now it seems like a bit of a burden. I'm like, gosh, it'd be nice to make things up a little bit more. So I'm going to start working on a novel, actually. And then meanwhile, I'm continuing to write the essays. I mean, the bug is there. I don't think it's going to go away soon.
Do you feel that when you're writing them, it's almost like writing an email to everyone or something?
Well, hopefully it's a little bit higher than email. You know, I'm really trying to extract something that's hopefully a little more witty and a little more literary from them. But in terms of the audience that I picture, yeah, it is a very conversational tone. If I picture a specific person, I get in trouble because then you start sort of altering what you write to please this sort of, you know, faceless person.
One final question. Why is it so hard and why is there so little in the way of humorous material that's really funny? What do you think that is? I mean, out there.
I think there's this concept that it's hard to write funny. And I think the reason why people think it's hard to write funny is they're looking at the wrong thing. It's not hard to write funny. It's really not. And I'm not saying that in a sort of vain, so like a funny factory. It's more because you have to have the reasoning and the heart and the unusual situation. It's hard to write sincere. But if you write sincerely about something funny that happened to you, then it'll end up being very funny. That's why it's difficult, because I think people are just trying to imitate the end result.
You've been listening to an interview with Sloan Crosley, whose collection of essays, humorous essays, about growing up in New York and living in New York, I Was Told There'd Be Cake. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.